You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Visit bpn.fm to discover more.
Welcome to The Fabulous Invalid, a Broadway-centric podcast where we take an in-depth look at the theater through interviews with actors, directors, writers, and everyone in between. I'm Jamie Dumont, recovering Broadway marketer, personal chef, and event planner.
And I'm Rob Russo, writer and theater critic with StageLeft.nyc.
Hi, Rob.
Hi, Jamie.
Well, I'm very excited about today.
I know. This is an episode long in development for us.
We've been talking about doing this episode for over a year.
I mean, like since we met.
Yeah.
Basically.
Like, yeah, pretty much since like May of 2018.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow. Yeah, well, it's here. Day has arrived.
It's happening. Should we tell people what we're doing?
Yeah, Rob, you do it.
Okay. Well, today we're going to spotlight a show that we are both madly in love with. It's called Soft Power, self-described as a musical within a play, currently playing at the Public Theater downtown. Book and lyrics by David Henry Huang, and music and additional lyrics by Janine Tesori. It's a really interesting show to describe, and in fact, we asked David when he was on the show with us almost a year ago to describe it.
Beautiful job.
He did a beautiful job. So I'm going to read his description because it's going to be way better than anything that either one of us would have come up with on our own. So Soft Power is a play that becomes a musical. The first 20 minutes is a comedy that takes place in 2016, and then the show jumps 100 years into the future, and the incident we just saw has been mythologized and become the source material for a beloved East-West musical in China. So theoretically, what you're watching for the rest of the show is a future Chinese musical that celebrates from a Chinese point of view how China stepped in to lead the world when America collapsed after the 2016 election. So it's sort of a reverse King and I,
yes,
if you will, at least, you know, structurally or in.
And that's how they describe it.
Exactly. Yeah. So returning to the show with us 1 year later is playwright David Henry Huang. If you don't know, he is a Tony Award-winning playwright, a two-time Pulitzer Prize finalist, and a three-time Obie Award winner. His works include M. Butterfly, Yellowface, and Chinglish, which was directed by another one of our guests today, Lee Silverman.
Lee is best known for her Tony Award-nominated direction of Violet on Broadway, as well as Lisa Kron's Well and Lifespan of a Fact, and off-Broadway, Harry Clark, Go Back Where You Are, and In the Wake.
After we speak with David and Lee, we will be joined by Soft Power cast members Francis Zhu and Elise Allen Lewis. Francis has a long association with David, performing in his plays M. Butterfly, Yellowface, and Kung Fu, and is actually playing the character of David Henry Huang, or DHH, in Soft Power.
And Elise, who was seen on Broadway in Amelie, Disaster, and Mamma Mia, is playing a character that I think Rob is very familiar with, and that would be his boss, Secretary Hillary Rodham Clinton.
Yes, I have to say, it was both times. When I first saw the show and seeing it again at the Public, it's such a fascinating experience to watch someone who you know be represented on stage. And I'll talk a little bit more about that at the end of the show.
Good, well, let's get to our guests.
Let's do it. But first, we have one little nugget of news that we're not breaking, but we want to share with you.
Oh, that's right.
And that is that our beloved co-host, Jennifer Simard, has been cast in the Broadway revival of Company.
We're very excited for Jennifer.
We are overwhelmed with glee. I called her and left like a really long and emotional voicemail after I heard the news because, first of all, I love this production. I saw it in London last year. We talked about it on the show. Second of all, I'm just so excited to see her play Sarah, right?
Sarah,
which was the part originally created by Barbara Barry, right?
It was, in fact,
in 1970,
I cannot think of a better actor to play that part.
Right?
Currently working in New York City.
Oh, my gosh. So we love you, Jennifer. We're so, so excited. And we can't wait to see you on stage this spring.
Yeah,
back on stage. I mean, we see her on stage at Mean Girls right now.
Yes, we've seen her several times.
But we'll see her in the spring. Alrighty, so got that off my chest. Let's get to our interviews.
Let's do it. David and Lee, welcome to The Fabulous Invalid. Thanks for coming down.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us back.
Yes, that's right, David, yes. This is your repeat. It was almost a year ago
yeah.
we chatted.
Yeah.
It's our anniversary.
Yeah.
Well, Soft Power, musical that we, you know, just adore, is a very unique show that requires its own very unique description. And last year we put David to the test and we asked him to give us his elevator pitch for the show, and he knocked it out of the park, of course. So Lee, we're going to put you on the spot.
Oh no!
And say,
I was like, what's David
going to
say?
So Lee, how do you describe the show to folks when they ask you, what is Soft Power?
So Soft Power is a musical about our current political moment. It is a show that follows a guy named David Henry Wong during a time that he met a Chinese theater producer who was in this country. He was working on a musical with him at the time of the 2016 election, and which didn't turn out so well, and then the subsequent hate crime that was inflicted on David. And basically what the show does is examine both this period of time in David's life and the period of time that we are now currently going through, and how he was stabbed in the neck and this country was stabbed in the neck in musical form.
In 2008, Soft Power premiered at the Amundsen Theater in
2018.
What did I say? 2008. Pardon me. I'm on very little sleep.
That would be quite a long development.
Yeah, really. I mean, not unheard of.
Not unheard of. Exactly.
Spring of last year, 2018.
Yes.
It premiered at the Amundsen Theater, and then it moved up to the Curran in San Francisco, and now it's at the Public Theater. What has changed with the show since California to now New York?
I think the change has fallen to a few different areas. One is that a woman sitting next to me, Lee Silverman, as well as composer Janine Tesori and our producer dramaturg Oscar Eustace, really sort of dragged me kicking and screaming into looking at my character more seriously and what happened to me with more weight. And similarly, the musical itself, while I think still has a lot of hilarious moments, I think we also took that more seriously, and we tried to pare down some of the things that were sort of sillier in the California version. The play that leads into the musical has been radically rewritten to really hopefully focus the audience to understand what they're seeing when they come to the musical, to understand that this is what happens when David's stabbed and he passes out and has this kind of fever dream.
Well, it's a tricky thing, I imagine, to write the musical sequence of the show, because it is supposed to be sort of the greatest entertainment that, you know, that the Chinese writers have written, right? So you're 100 years roughly in the future seeing this polished, you know, gem of Chinese musical theater, if that's the phrase you would want to use. But at the same time, so much of it is a satire of our own contemporary society. So how did you navigate having to sort of pull off both of those things?
Well, and to add to that, also really the whole thing is in David's mind.
Right.
So really the whole thing is, you know, it with kind of the Wizard of Oz as our North Star. It's like, you know, there is this play, this crime happens, he loses consciousness and then has this musical fever dream in which he imagines what it would be like if this, you know, polished gem of a musical was made from China's point of view. And I think that as we've looked at the form and tried to figure out what's delicious about seeing some things twice played out exactly the same, what's interesting about seeing things played out in the opposite from how we saw it at the beginning, and what just feels a little bit like we've already seen it, who cares? And that has been a really big part of looking at how the form works and how to make it feel both delicious, exciting, unpredictable, and also clear in terms of our point of view and intention. So much of the work that we did from LA and San Francisco to get to here, I think, has to do with looking at how those events that we see in the play unspool in the musical.
And I think we're also looking to replicate the sort of passion and craftsmanship and heart of the great musicals from, you know, the sort of first golden age of musicals in America. And if you look at the content of a lot of those musicals, you know, there's a lot of stuff in it that's really questionable or just wrong. And so the idea of creating a musical where the story we know is wrong, and yet being able to do it with that degree of heart and commitment. We certainly wouldn't have been able to pull it off without Janine Tesori. Mm.
And I think one of the things that's so incredible about the score is you can know everything about the American musical theater canon and hear the way that she's quoting every single major musical inside of all of our songs, or you can know nothing about musical theater and just feel like these songs are fun, romantic, soaring, all of these incredible, because her skill is so amazing. And I think that is such an incredible thing, to be able to have the score understood on multiple levels, mm-hmm. and that you can come to it without knowing anything, or you can know, oh, right, that's Music Man. Oh, that was Oklahoma. That was, you know, and you can feel the way that she's quoting and really turning music that we know and love so well into her own and kind of reappropriating it into this musical in a way that is so, I think, unbelievably good.
As Zoe says, it's the delivery system, right?
The delivery mm-hmm. system,
and
yes.
And if you've got all the right ingredients, you know, it strikes you and it hits you at the heart.
Yeah.
Right, which is really a term that I appropriated from Janine Tesori. Zoe's mouth.
So maybe there's a little bit of Janine and Zoe there. Yeah. She's like, you're not the only analog of the show. This is a show, obviously, given the plot and the setting of it, that tackles, you know, a host of contemporary social, political, cultural issues. So much so that, you know, every night, almost, the audience... The show can impact the audience in a different way based off of that day's news. How do you navigate that minefield, you know, from a writing perspective and from a directing perspective?
I mean, I think it was fairly obvious after the 2016 election that there were certain things that were going to play out over the next few years, including some sort of conflict with China. It was that a nationalistic government was going to feel threatened by the rise of a rival power and try to do something to stop that. So there are things like that that are in the show that, yes, have turned out to be true on some level, but I feel were fairly easy to predict.
For you. And then every day I'm like, how did he know that was going to happen?
And then there's some things that we just lucked out at, you know, like the fast food and the prevalence of fast food in the current White House.
Yeah, I mean it really speaks to how prescient David's been and how clear he was about what would happen. And I would say that 4 years ago, before the 2016 election, when we started working on the show, it seemed like we were making a show that would be weird and crazy and sci-fi and fantastical. And in some ways, the world that we're living in now is weirder and more fantastical than our show. In many ways, in fact. And the idea that we would be questioning democracy, that we would be practically in a war with China, mm-hmm. that we would think that our government was run by buffoons, I mean that the whole system that we were living inside of would be something that we would really think twice about on a regular basis, about do we have the best system or not? I mean, that very question, the idea that we would be in a situation that we would be thinking about that all the time, every day, that question would be rolling around in our brains, is democracy something that we want to hold on to? It seemed impossible. It seemed like that would never be and have an urgency that it does right now. And here we are, that question is more urgent than ever, particularly as we face the 2020 election.
When do we vote?
When do we vote?
On the Tuesday after the first Monday in the month of November.
The month of November, on the Tuesday after the first Monday in the month of November.
So in many ways, it seems like the idea of the show has only been, it was easy to move the show in a direction of taking itself more seriously because we take it more seriously because the questions feel less crazy and more, in fact, part of our everyday fabric of our lives.
And in the same way that, you know, one can say that America was stabbed in the neck in 2016, we can also say that we've all been living in a sort of a fever dream since 2016, that the things that we accept as normal now would have been kind of unimaginable 5 years ago. And so the fact that David falls into a fever dream in this show and dreams this musical, it also sort of functions as a metaphor for where we all are as a country. I mean, an original version of this show was trying to investigate China's desire to gain soft power. And I think what the 2016 election did was make this a show which maybe starts out with that question, but certainly ends with the question, has America, to what extent are we losing our soft power? And is there the possibility of regaining it? So I do feel that, you know, we're living through this this big historical moment. And it's hard to write about the time you're living in. So the device here to sort of pull back and try to perceive it, yes, it's in David's heads, but David is trying to look at it as if from the lens of history, I think helps to kind of process a method for looking at the times that we are in right now.
And something that I thought of the first time I even read about the show is the fact that now that this musical within a play, to use the proper line, exists, it is now a part of history, and it will exist, you know, forever, as long as, you know, we're recording things and passing them down and sharing them. And you talked about, when we talked with you last year, the fact that there are very few musicals about Asian Americans or with Asian American characters. And this is now a new entry into a short list of musicals that call for a cast with Asian American actors. And that's very exciting. And certainly by the end of the show, all that point is very clearly made and is very powerful. And that is something that has changed, right, since the original production.
Yeah, I mean, the ending is different here than it was in California. I think the California ending was more of a sort of full-throated, one might say, simpler affirmation of democracy, as opposed to this version, which we really worked on to ask a question, which is, you know, are we going to survive as a democracy? Are the sort of current crisis of democracy that's happening all over the world, really, not just here? And if so, how can we inject a sort of note of hope, however tentative? And I think that's how it ends now, also affirming this notion of having an all-Asian or virtually all-Asian cast on stage, which is talking about America, which is commenting on this country, whereas so many times we are considered not part of this country. We're considered sort of perpetual foreigners.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a revolution to have a show that has mostly all but one Asian American actors on stage who are being asked to do things that typically Asian American actors are not asked to do, be in leading roles, not just be sidekicks, not just be sexy girlfriends, but to in fact inhabit and embody every single character with a sense of humor and a sense of style and a sense of seriousness and gravitas. And I think it's... I mean, I think a lot about, because we're on the Newman stage, which is where A Chorus Line was done, and I think about what it must have felt like at that time to see that show, and I look at our cast, and I think it's a bold statement, and I think it's a really important one in this moment to say, this is a story that needs to be taken seriously, and not only because of the story itself, but because of the people who are telling it. And it really asks the audience to understand, I think, because of the King and I reference, because of the way the show is set up, that this is a cast of people who haven't been looked at enough and haven't been given the respect that they deserve and the parts that they should have. And it feels like a dare, and in a way, I mean, it's one of the things that I love most about the end of the show, to see them there saying, this is America. And I think it's a very, it feels particularly right now, it's it feels like, how can you turn away from that?
And just to be specific about your referencing earlier, sort of the paucity of these sorts of shows, this is really the third show in all of Broadway history that has that features Asians as Americans,
right.
As opposed to Asians being foreigners.
Right.
I mean, in a very early rehearsal, one of the women in our company said that, you know, she had never really been in a show where she hasn't had to bow to a man.
Wow.
And I was very moved by that. And certainly if that is not the experience of white actresses, white musical theater actresses, you know, they can say, oh, I have had, you know, crappy parts. But to be able to say that, and that this is the first show for her where that's true, I think it's, what's more important than to feel like you can be in a show and have more experiences than just that?
Let's hope it's the beginning of a huge shift.
Let's hope.
Well, speaking of shifts, Lee, has your relationship to The King and I changed drastically since you've started working on this show?
Well, you know, it's so funny. I've always, whatever about The King and I. But, you know, David and I saw The King and I together because one of our other collaborators, Hoon Lee, who we worked with on Yellowface, was in The King and I at Lincoln Center, and we went to see it. And it's funny to think about us sitting in that theater at that time, being really excited and proud of Hoon, that now we've now spent all these years working on this other show, which is really takes that show apart. But I do, I guess what I feel like is I think you agree with this, but I believe The King and I should be done. I don't think that we should stop doing musicals. What I believe, and I have directed other revivals of problematic musicals, and you know, I think that what they need is a point of view, and that they need an understanding of what the material is, and it needs to be examined so that they're not museum pieces, but they're done with respect, and they're done with a look at what's problematic about them and a rigor. And so I think that, do I speak for you when I say that? So so just to say, I think The King and I is incredible. Many of the people in our cast have been in The King and I multiples and multiples of times. And, you know, it's a show that should be done. I just think, you know, what I would love to see is like a double bill or like a two-parter where you see The King and I and then you see Soft Power, because I actually think they would talk so beautifully to each other. And in fact, you know, what R&H did with that score, what Janine has done with our score. I mean, they those pieces are they're communicating across time. And so I wanted it to be done, but I would also like it to be done with people having an understanding of what they're seeing. And I do feel like Soft Power brings some of that understanding to people who maybe haven't thought of it quite that way.
The notion of Soft Power and The King and I only being done in rep moving forward. That to me is like, sign me up. Call Lincoln Center Theater.
I know, right?
Call whomever. Just let's make that happen.
Dueling polkas, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
But it's true. It's through that lens, you know, if you look back and through the lens of how something was made, but what's wrong with it and how we can change is how change happens, right?
Yeah.
That's an important part of why it shouldn't just be a museum piece. You have to take a fresh look at it and examine what's really in there.
Yeah,
I think you have to hold somewhat competing notions in your head, which is King and I is a beautiful musical. It's almost arguably, perfectly constructed. It was very progressive for its time. And we can appreciate those things while also understanding the degree to which there are things that just are probably wrong about it.
We have one, we have two questions left that we wanted to ask each of you. The question that the show asks at the end, which is, do you still believe in democracy?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's flawed. It's frequently maddening. And I think the just like works of art and people and all the things that matter, like the harder they are, usually the more worth it they are. And I think that we are in a place right now where we're feeling how important it is because it's slipping away. Mm. And I feel that very consciously. I don't know. I think I would have taken it for granted, actually, if it wasn't for this moment. And if there's any silver lining to this, total shit show that we're in right now, it would be that I think we've all come to appreciate, or at least I feel strongly that I've come to appreciate what we have in a way that if we hadn't had to fight for it, I wouldn't have understood it. And it has made me want to understand our Constitution. It has made me want to understand how art can function in this time. I think it has made many pieces of theater that feel urgent and necessary. I think it has made those pieces more widely accessible, and because more people want to come together and commune and figure it out. So I guess what I feel like is yes, and also we have to look at it. I think just we were saying about old musicals, we have to look at it and say, they made that document a long time ago. And what can we bring to it with fresh eyes? And who does it leave out? And in what ways? And in what kind of what kind of holes are there inside of that idea of democracy that has allowed for this situation to happen?
And, at the end of our show, the DHH character is sort of given the opportunity to go to China if he wants to feel safer and chooses not to go. And I, that's my position, too. I mean, I don't want to live in China. I don't want to live in an authoritarian system. So I believe in democracy, and majoritarian democracy, just a voting in and of itself, is probably not sufficient. We need democracy, and we need education, and we need a means of dialogue, and we need to respect our social structures and strengthen them. So democracy exists within a whole context, which we also need to be attentive to, and which has rapidly eroded over the past few decades.
Just letting that one sink for a second. And it also sounds like the Constitution's in need of a rewrite.
Potentially, yeah. I mean, I think that's what Heidi Schreck's show, we talk about Heidi's show all the time. Yeah. And I mean, there's a couple of plays that we have used as real beacons for us over these couple of years. Anne Washburn's play, Mr. Burns, is one. Yeah. Heidi's play more recently. And I think that that question that Heidi poses at the end of the play and the way that that play works has very much influenced. I think we were all really taken with it. We all saw it multiple times, and I think it's just asking the question feels, it felt so radical, and now it feels like, how could we not?
Right.
How could we not?
Well, we had one last question that we wanted to ask Lee.
Yeah.
Since we asked you, David, last time when you were on the show. This is our perennial question we ask everyone.
We ask everyone.
Oh, good.
You're in good company.
Okay.
Which is, what was the show or experience that happened earlier in your life that made you want to work in the theater?
Oh, wow. There were so many. I mean, I grew up in Washington, D.C., and so I went to Arena Stage, and Zelda Fitchhandler ran that theater. And I can honestly say, because of her, and because I had the opportunity to see plays that she directed, and she was running that theater, and I was just like, of course, you know, women. And it wasn't until much later that I was like, oh wait, that's weird. Oh, you know, because it felt so. I feel like that was a big part of it. And then I think that I saw Lily Tomlin's solo show that she did when it was touring through the Kennedy Center, and I was 10. And I just felt like every hair on my body just stood up, and I thought that was the most incredible writing. And I remember, you know, I remember my parents sort of feeling like maybe that play was too weird for me or too sophisticated. And then I remember, you know, I begged them to buy it for me, and I just was poring over it in my bedroom, and I thought, oh, words can do magic, and there is a kind of unbelievable liminal space that happens between a word on a page and then the way that someone can perform it. And and I was also an only child and extremely bossy, so I was like, I need to figure out how to get in there with somebody and make that happen, because I was really excited about that play, and I think it inspired me to want to do it, and also to figure out how it worked so well. Like, why did that play work like that? And partly it was the text, and partly it was the performance, and partly it was the magic in between.
Well, thank you for sharing your magic with us. We're all the lucky beneficiaries of Soft Power and your creative brilliance, both of you. Thanks for coming down and chatting with us.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, guys.
Great to be here.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFF's creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFF's The Original New Musical from Shayna Taub is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
Now we're joined by two of the show stars, Frances Jew and Elise Allen Lewis. Welcome to The Fabulous Invalid.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for coming down.
Thank you.
Very excited.
Maybe, Elise, we'll start with you. What was your relationship to The King and I before you started working on this show?
The King and I was actually one of my first shows as a child. I played the littlest child in Upper Darby Summer Stage's production of The King and I in Upper Darby, Pennsylvania.
Excellent.
Yes.
Frances.
I really wish I'd played the king in your production. Just turning you around would have been just awesome. The whole reason why I'm in this business is because I saw my third oldest brother, Jeff, play the prince in a high school production of The King and I, which was brilliant. He was one of two Asian people in the company. But I was so entranced by this beautiful show, which the high school drama teacher had choreographed with all of the original Jerome Robbins choreography, and it was just beautiful, and I couldn't believe that Mrs. Anna was actually crying on stage, and I was so shy. I couldn't talk to people when I was 11, 12 years old, and I just knew that that's what I had to do, and that everyone in that show was Siamese. It was like, having grown up Catholic, it was like the Transfiguration. It was a really spiritual moment. And then eventually, I got to play the king in a few different productions. And I at first turned it down because I didn't want to embarrass myself, because the only Kings I had ever seen had pecs the size of my head. And I was like, I'm not going to take my shirt off. If I'm doing it, I'm not going to take my shirt off. And I'm going to study the real King, and I'm going to try to inject that into it. And Paul Blake at the Muni said, well, all right. That's the kind of King I want. Okay. And
my God, you do a great Paul Blake, by
oh,
the way.
I love Paul. And he invited me over to his apartment to show me costume renderings of all the vests I would wear so I wouldn't have to take off my shirt. And then I got to the Muni, and it's 105 degrees in the shade. And I'm like, please, can I take my clothes off?
An all-nude production of the King and I.
Exactly.
That's the concept.
Yeah.
It's all Calcutta.
It was great. It was actually really great.
Well, jumping forward to soft power, you each are in the unique position of playing characters that are based off of real people, and real people who are, you know, still alive and in the world very much. Elise, you play, of course, a fictionalized version of Hillary Rodham Clinton.
Yes.
And Francis, you play a fictionalized version of the playwright David Henry Hwang,
who
just spoke to. No pressure, right? So what's it like for each of you stepping into the shoes of a real person? I'm doing air quotes right now, a real person every night.
I think I took that on so much out of town when we did the show. Even though I'm playing a fictionalized version of Hillary, I definitely took that pressure on of there being a real person who I admire in the world and me playing a character by that name. As I've lived in the piece and found my fictionalized version of this character, it's changed the way that I am in every room that I walk into in this business now, working on this show. It's been life-changing.
Wow. When you say it's changed, you know, who you are, can you fold that a little bit for us?
Yeah, I think this character, Zoe, who I play in the play,
right, right.
And Hillary, mm-hmm. I believe that you're seeing the character of Hillary in public and in private in a way that I've never played a character like this on stage. Mm-hmm. And I think in building the character of Hillary, there's been many moments of having to demand attention and not ask for permission. And this is something that I have had trouble with as an actress in this business. Wow. Standing up, standing still, demanding attention without asking for permission. Physically standing in a room without apology, not apologizing for things I'm not sorry for, breaking down my own conditioning as a woman in the profession that we're in. And I'm sure it's also because with Lee and Janine at the helm, I have two women who have encouraged me to do so because I watch them do that in our room. So that's what it's like.
Yeah. Wow.
Building this show, building this character. Mm-hmm. It's really been life-changing to step out of this room and go into others and say, okay, I'm going to demand attention and not ask for permission right. in every room. And hard. Difficult. Still those moments where I'm like, am I a bitch? Am I asking too much? Do I deserve this? But
yes,
also,
you do. No, you're not.
But also,
keep doing
but
it.
Also, that's what this character, I feel like,
right?
is also going through. I know nothing yeah. about being in politics, but I know a lot about being in a business where you're right. performing.
It's a big, big show.
Yeah, you're performing 100% of the time. You know, who am I not performing for? This is something I think about when I'm playing this character. And so in building her and thinking about it in terms of my own life, this fictionalized Hillary, also this character of Zoe, it's really now a part of how I see myself going on from this room and taking it into others.
Wow. Francis.
Well, before I talk about me, I'm grateful for this opportunity to say something about Elise. Yes. In public. And I just have to say that over the course of, you know, almost 2 years now, watching her build this character and help to build this company and help to build this show, which has, as you know and have seen, has evolved over time, both in its tone and in how seriously it takes itself, I have been amazed and awed by how courageous Elise is.
it's broken my heart so many times before, but this one was the worst. Left me screaming on the floor. I was taught in the land of the free. Democracy.
It has made me braver to watch you, Elise, and as the creative team has really been tough on themselves, where the relationship between this Chinese producer and Hillary Clinton is concerned, and then as they got tough on themselves about answering the question, why is David in this play? Why did he put himself in the middle of this play that becomes a musical? And what does it mean that David, in fact, got stabbed in the middle of the street? And, you know, there are plenty of ways to make a joke out of it. I mean, he indeed did return the groceries home before he walked himself to the hospital. He did indeed say, I think I'm going to faint now, before he passed out once reaching the ER. And, you know, as soon as he woke up in the hospital, he was already on Facebook making jokes about it. The man is incredibly brilliant and funny, and has a great way of turning things into hilarious stories. But I think over the course of working on this show in the last 3 years, he's really started to cope with what it means in the current context in this country as well, to have been a victim of a hate crime and almost dying, and being a rich, successful, renowned leader in his industry and in the community, and none of that protected him. And what does it mean to assume that you're an American with certain rights and suddenly none of that actually matters? In a moment, and for that not to be solved. And because he's had to face all of that, playing him in the show, I've had to face all of that. And we've actually, particularly about the very end of the show, in rehearsals, had discussions about being an other. And how you grow up censoring yourself, you grow up wondering if you're ever going to reveal the thing that gets you excluded, saying the wrong thing, wearing the wrong thing, behaving the wrong way, whether it's because I'm Asian or because I'm gay or because I'm little or because everyone assumes I'm a tenor and I'm not. You know, it's all of those things that add up to you, as Elise said so articulately, not assuming when you walk into a room that you can just take up space, that you have to ask for it, you have to apologize for it, you have to make a joke about it. And I think for even for David, that was a discovery that, you know, he'd been anticipating being attacked ever since he was aware that he was different. And when I look at the rest of this company on stage at the very end of the show, and I know how talented they are, how devoted they are, how disciplined they are, how and what great people they are too, and to know that the vast majority of them are only waiting for the next audition for Miss Saigon or The King and I, that breaks my heart every single performance. And and then I get to look at the audience and ask them, do you see them in other shows? Do you see them as human beings, that you can relate to? And I gotta say, it's because this show is so beautifully written and beautifully staged that it has never failed to move me when I look out at the house and see people really understanding and feeling the same sense of trauma, and so sympathizing in a really emotional way. And it's so generous, I think, of David, because he could have looked at the audience and said, fuck you.
Yeah.
You're part of the problem. Yeah. You stabbed me. But what he actually is saying is, we've all been stabbed. We're all living with this trauma. No matter what side you're on, what aisle, side of the aisle you're on, everyone is feeling attacked.
Yeah.
Everyone is feeling victimized by this time that we're living in. Some people started feeling that when they were little. Other people started feeling that in 2016.
Right.
So, you know, and he doesn't have an answer. He's just asking the question, you know, what are we going to do? What, 10, 11 years ago when he wrote Yellow Face, very late in the process, he added a line for his own character at the end, which is a show all about mistaken identity and, you know, a white person shouldn't play an Asian person on stage. And he mistakenly casts a white person as a yellow person in his play, and, you know, drama and hilarity ensues. And at the end of the play, the character who represents himself says, if my father imagined that he could be Jimmy Stewart, why can't a white person play an Asian person on stage? And for a while, when that line was introduced in the script, the company really flinched. Like, isn't that not what we're saying in his play? And yet, that truly is what David is driving at. Yeah. We're not there yet, perhaps, where I or he would say, yeah, it's okay for, you know, a white person to play the king or to play DHH in Soft Power. But isn't that the goal? You know, we do have ideals. And in Soft Power, the ideals are what we learned in the Pledge of Allegiance and the preamble to the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, and we're not living up to it. Mm. We never have completely. We're closer than we were, but we ain't there yet.
Mm. Well, Elise, I'm interested to hear from your perspective as the only white person in the cast. You know, you and your standby are the only white actors in this ensemble. What has that sort of taught you?
I think it's more important that I'm surrounded by an entirely Asian American cast, mm-hmm. Rather than me being the only white person.
Sure.
I think that being a part of this family, who really at this point we're all family, the way that my Asian American cast members have trusted me with their stories, trusted me with their feelings, felt like they could share that with me, they could share their experiences. It's given me just an understanding, a compassion, an empathy for what they've been through, and that's what this experience has been like for me being with them. They're my chosen family. They're my family at this point.
You know, I don't know if you know this, Elise, but I work for Hillary Clinton.
Yes.
There you go. So
I do. Yeah.
I want to hear all about that experience.
Me too. Me too.
Those campaigns and the night, you know.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I was there through it all, you know. But it was interesting as twice. Yeah. No, in 08 and 2016. Yeah. It's been quite a journey. But I talked to her about the show when I first saw it in L.A. because I did catch the show at the Amundsen. And, you know, every time I see something where she's a character, which isn't that often, but, you know, I have an extra set of antenna up about, like, okay, well, how am I going to feel about this since I know this person, right?
Yes.
You know? And what I said to her afterwards was, you know, it's a very, you know, humane portrait of you. And, you know, you're definitely a character, right? I mean, it's, you know, because obviously it's an imagined story, right? I mean, you didn't actually fall in love with a Chinese film executive. What I said to her was, there's one part in the beginning of Act Two where, you know, she's cramming pizza and ice cream down her throat. And I don't know, that just felt like maybe that wasn't you. And she laughed and said, well, actually, not too far off. Yes.
I'm really proud of that moment.
Yes,
I'm very proud of that moment because as we staged that, as I was with David, Lee, Janine staging that moment, when I would get food, you know, on my face, on my hands, and I'd wipe it off, and have these long conversations with them about the fact that, but you're in private, nobody's with you, and what do we do to cope?
Right.
What do we do to self-soothe? Mm-hmm. And so this is sort of what I mean about it's in the last number, democracy, when I'm singing out there and I'm alone and I'm talking about my belief system, but there's also an unapologetic nature to expressing what you're going through in private, no matter what feelings come out, mm-hmm. how hurt you are, how you feel in the moment, eating your feelings, making sure that I'm not taking anything away from my face, my hands. Janine and Lee would be like, do not wipe anything off. As you're eating, as you are...
That had to have been hard.
I think it felt, in many ways, very freeing. It felt extremely freeing to feel like I am enough, just as I am here, mm-hmm. with mm-hmm. food on my face, in a tattered suit, expressing my anger, my sadness, laughing through it, crying through it. These are things that I admire about the character I'm playing. Mm-hmm. And these are things that I would hope, if the real Hillary saw our show, that she would find relatable.
Right.
And at times, I mean, we say all the time, I say all the time, like, I don't care what people think. I don't care, right? But I do. And I think in terms of my journey with this show, Out of Town and Here, I sometimes worry, or I sometimes have thought about, like, well, do I get pressure put on me to be the real Hillary? Although sometimes I feel like if the real Hillary was playing this character, people would still think that she wasn't real enough.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's what we put her through as mm-hmm. a nation when she ran. And so there are many times where I feel that, I think that's actually given me even more strength in this run, feeling like, well, my version of this person is who you get. And if you think that another performer should be playing her, or you think that if the real person was playing her, that wouldn't be enough, I don't know who would be able to play her because that's also how this character is built.
Yeah.
She's built to not be able to do enough. And as women, I think we know that feeling all too well. Mm-hmm. So that's been really interesting for me.
Yeah, I was just about to say, I mean, that's the brilliance of David and selecting. I mean, you could have chosen any political figure. You could have set this in any time. You could have used any convention he wanted, and he chose Hillary Clinton for a reason, right? Because of what you've just said, right? I mean, the endless unpacking and criticism, and, you know, it makes for... To put that character on stage, her as a character on stage, you mm-hmm. know, it opens up so many possibilities, and to talk about a lot of, you know, the way that our culture looks at women.
Yes.
Yeah. Women in politics, you know, as a separate,
totally.
You know, category, and our politicians generally, right? I mm-hmm. mean, the idea of putting on a show of, you know, policy plans not being good enough. Mm-hmm. That you still have to take those selfies and you still have to tap dance, essentially.
And mm-hmm. twerk.
And twerk.
Twerk for those votes.
Exactly. Twerk for those
votes. Twerking for votes.
That should go on a button.
You know? And feel like as we were building that dance number as well, that to change the tone from in the moments where, I don't want to give much away about that number because a lot happens, but there's a moment where if she's dancing for her voters and there's a particular style of dance that's, say, a little more risque than another part of the dance, there were times where I would be like sticking out my tongue as I was doing those moves. And so our choreographer, Sam Pinkleton, our associate, Sunny Hit, Lee, Janine, David, we'd have these long conversations about the fact that to be that cheeky about the style of dance or to not really take it seriously that you're getting people on your side, that's when the tone changes from satiric to serious to mm-hmm. true. How can I perform this dance and really feel like I am pulling out all the stops for the people that I love because, and I don't know Hillary personally, but what I think I know about this person or the essence of her is how much she loves the people. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so then it's those moments of being like, it's easier to be funny because it's harder to stay true. And so I think that's also been something that has shifted with all of us. As we worked on this piece again, that's been something that the team has really talked with us about. Like, it is much easier to be funny, to laugh something off, to be cheeky, you know? And I think it's harder to actually commit to the truth.
Yeah, my experience of people after the show coming up to me and commenting on the fact that Hillary is in the show, if they loved Hillary already, it was just such wish fulfillment. Like, we wish that she could eat pizza and ice cream and fall in love and be loved back, you know. And for those people, even, you know, progressive liberal people who did not like Hillary, they, to a person, have said to me that they came to an understanding and a sympathy for Hillary that they hadn't realized that they could possibly feel for her. I will say at one particular talkback after a show, a woman raised her hand and she really wanted to know, her burning question was, in real life, did Hillary kiss the Chinese man? And that's how good this delivery system right. is of musicals, right? She thought that we were depicting something that really happened. Might have really happened. And I asked her, well, what do you hope happened? And she says, well, if she wasn't married, I hope she went for it. And, you know, I just think that's one of the best things I've ever heard about the show.
Well, there is a question that the show asks that is, you know, pretty obvious, and you've seen it. But in the end, you know, essentially, Hillary's point, which is inspired by Zoe's point very early in the play, yes. It's so tautly written, is, you know, do you still believe in democracy? And it's a question that, you know, we were just talking to Lee and David that, you know, many of us have never asked or had to think about until the past couple of years. So I'll throw the question to you as Francis and Elise, not Hillary and DHH. Do you still believe in democracy?
I believe in theater, which is largely a totalitarian regime. But I believe in its aspirational aspects, like going back to when I was a kid and watching a high school production of The King and I, and it allows us to imagine a better world, sometimes in hilarious and ridiculous ways, sometimes in really dramatic ways, but it gets us outside of ourselves. We get to identify with someone else. It's an act of compassion. And I think that that's what democracy is it has all of that potential. And it has all of that hope that we are caring enough about other people to vote on certain things. But it's like any other system of government, it is imperfect. And maybe because people get to vote, you know, we're all so stupid about so many things. Why should I have a say in, you know, where the water pipes should be, you know, anything. So, yeah, I believe in democracy, but I don't think we are living in one quite yet.
I feel a complicated relationship with democracy. I think it's complicated. I would say that's something that's probably felt for many of us living in this country right now. But it gives me a lot of hope to be in a show like this and to be asking these questions. And if democracy is all about the people, like, I believe in people. I believe in the good of people. And so whether or not in that complication we can come to an understanding and create an even better belief system, that's my hope.
And I forget what I really should know. I forget that it's such a big, big show. Still I dream that our people can be wise enough.
enough,
wise enough,
just enough,
just enough, worthy of trust enough, kind enough, smart enough,
with a big heart enough, good and grown up enough,
to lift us up,
lift us up,
lift us up,
lift us up,
lift us up.
Rob here with You May Be Wondering. Following our conversations with Lee Silverman, David Henry Hwang, Elise Allen Lewis, and Francis Zhu about the brilliant musical within a play that is Soft Power, I have to admit, my head is spinning a little. When I first heard about the show in 2018, I just so happened to be heading to Los Angeles, so I bought a ticket, and I caught a performance at the Amundsen Theater, where it made its world premiere in a Center Theater Group production. As you may know from our interview with Hillary Rodham Clinton last season, or as you might have picked up from our conversations on this episode, I've worked for Secretary Clinton for over a decade now. And she just so happens to be a character in Soft Power, so I really had to see this show as soon as I could. You may be wondering, though, what is it like for me to see my boss reflected on stage as a character in a musical? Well, as she said on the show back in June, it's kind of an odd experience for her to see herself rendered as a character in any form of media, which makes sense. I mean, imagine if someone made a movie or a musical where you were a character. Of course, they'd get a lot wrong, because no one can truly know the truth of someone else's life. Then again, sometimes it does take a third party to point out elements of your own character that maybe you're just too close to see. Getting back to Secretary Clinton, I got this question a lot when Lucas Naif's play, Hillary and Clinton, was on Broadway last spring. That play is set in an alternate universe where a woman named Hillary, who is married to a man named Bill, who used to be president, is now running for president herself. Sound familiar? The play dramatized a short period of time in the lead-up to the New Hampshire primary in 2008, which then-Senator Clinton famously won, re-energizing her campaign. That play, which took a serious look at past events that are now history, attempted to demonstrate a psychological portrait of Secretary Clinton and her marriage. While I'm certainly too close to be objective, I didn't care for it. When it comes to Soft Power, though, the story is different. Instead of a thinly veiled examination of recent history, the musical within Soft Power is a fantasy, an imagined story involving Hillary Clinton that has become mythologized some 100 years into the future, and that exists entirely in the dream state of the character DHH after he's near fatally stabbed on a Brooklyn street. Since the character of Hillary is exactly that, a character existing in a fiction, seen through the eyes of Chinese musical theater writers in the future, there's a freedom of dramatic license that allows someone like me, who knows the real Hillary Clinton, and audiences writ large, to observe larger truths about the former First Lady, Senator, Secretary of State, and presidential candidate's status as a symbol, but also her legacy as a leader, divorced from the day-to-day back and forth of temporal politics. In this way, oddly enough, the Hillary Clinton of Soft Power comes across as more truthful than the Hillary Clinton of Hillary and Clinton, precisely because she's not meant to be the real thing. Obviously, they are two very different works, attempting to make different points and examine different aspects of Secretary Clinton's identity, symbolism, and place in history. But it just so happens that they both played New York in the span of 6 months. So, what is it like for me to see someone I know as a character in Soft Power? The truth is, whoever you are, you have a relationship with Hillary Clinton that will color how you see and perceive her portrayal on stage, which ultimately speaks to David Henry Hwang's intelligence as a writer and dramatist in choosing her as the American leader he'd mythologized in his reversed East-West musical within a play. The title, Soft Power, is a term coined by political scientist Joseph Nye that refers to the way in which the culture, political values, and foreign policies of a country can exert their influence around the world, non-coercively. In the show, there's a big debate about American democracy, as we talked about on this episode, and the power of our example around the world. In choosing Hillary Clinton, David was also choosing someone who, as a symbol, but also as a real person, a leader, has played a major role in flexing America's soft power, particularly in the way she comported herself following the 2016 election. Musicals are also a source of soft power, and this show in particular gives me hope for the future of the form and its influence both in America and around the world. Rob here. That's our show. Thanks for listening. You can hear us anytime on iTunes. The Fabulous Invalid is a production of O&M Etc. and The Fabulous Invalid LLC, and a proud member of the Broadway Podcast Network. Our theme music is by Lucky Chops. Today's episode was edited and engineered by Charles Van Kirk. You can find us online at thefabulousinvalid.com and on social media at Fabulous Invalid, and on iTunes, Spotify, and wherever you find your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, please rate and review us on iTunes. And be sure to tune in next Wednesday.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.